It's time for Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. With nationally recognized nature writer and award-winning horticulture and nature expert, Bill Finch. Bill shares his knowledge of conservation, natural history, and gardening. Let's talk about living and growing in the Deep South with your personal garden and nature consultant. Here's Bill Finch on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, welcome back. It's the Gulf Coast Sunday morning. It's an Alabama Sunday morning. I had a really interesting experience this past week visiting a place along the Gulf Coast that was the product of years of work by a lot of people. And it wasn't a building. It wasn't an industry. It was one of our real treasures. It was what we have that really no one else has. It was the upper part of the Mobile Tensaw Delta, which is the area just north of Mobile Bay, extending up, 35 miles, 40 miles, depending on how you view it, up into the interior of Alabama, into Monroe County and Clark counties. And we spent some time there because a guy from Mobile, who you should know, he's a really important person, not only for Mobile, but for all of Alabama. In fact, he lived in Decatur, he lived in Birmingham, he lived in Bruton, he lived in Mobile. These were all part of his growing up. He knew those places well. His name was E.O. Wilson. Ed Wilson is what he grew up being known as. I think he had a nickname. I think it was Snake Boy because he was so good at picking up snakes as a kid. People were very impressed by that. He often describes almost being bitten by a cottonmouth, I think, in one of his books. He went on to become a very famous scientist. One of the world's most famous scientists. In his day, he was certainly the most famous evolutionary biologist. The person who understood the ecology of a place, the forest, the insects, the birds, and how they all fit together. It was really important in that. His specialty was ants. He was one of the first people to ever describe that annoying little creature that every one of you has in your garden and that you fight with every day, the imported red fire ant. That fire ant has changed a little bit since Ed first described it. It was originally one species, and then it became another species as we introduced more things into the port of Mobile. And we had two species of ants, and they both, in many ways, merged or probably hybridized to some degree. Ed was the first person to really put a name on that. And he, as a teenager... And so as he gained prominence in the science world, he went on to become head of Harvard's Evolutionary Biology Department and one of the great scientific authors of all times. He developed words that are very important to us now. Words like biodiversity. Ed and some of his colleagues were kicking that word around and trying to find a word that captured the idea of how do we express the richness of species, the richness of things, the sundriness of things, all these different things out there. How do we express that? Let's call it biodiversity. And Ed, I think, certainly was popularized that term, injected it into our language in a major way. and wrote a number of other prominent books. And I think if I had to boil down Ed's ideas into one thought, and this is a thought that I carry with me all the time, and it's a big part of our program here. If you want to know who you are, you got to know the world around you. And you'll never understand yourself if you don't understand all those species. All those things, the sundriness of things around you. It's really important. How do you understand biodiversity? It's important to understanding who you are. And it's important for a lot of reasons. Oh, let's say it didn't shape your genes, which it did. It certainly shapes what you do in your garden. It certainly shapes how you breathe. It certainly shapes the food that you eat. It certainly shapes the water that you drink. It shapes the temperature around you. It shapes when it rains and when it doesn't rain on you. All of these things are critical to understanding who you are and what you can do and what you can accomplish, and certainly where you are. Ed was very important. So one of the things, Ed died a few years ago. He's in his 90s. He'd spent a lot of time working in Alabama, and we looked for a fitting memorial. And a lot of people got involved, including Chris Tompkins and Melinda Chouinard and Patagonia and the Nature Conservancy and the E. O. Wilson Biodiversity Foundation. And we talked to Ed, and we talked about where can we make a memorial to what Ed has meant for this place. And Ed would have loved for that to have been Blakely. But Blakely is hemmed in now. It's development has probably eliminated the potential for conservation around the park. It became very difficult. One of the areas that we found was an area that we had been thinking about for a long time. And another famous guy named William Bartram came through in 1776, 77, about then, and described that place when he stopped at Mobile and he took his boat up along the Tombigbee River. And his description of that place was so intense and so beautiful that it influenced poets in Europe, and even poets like Samuel Taylor Coleridge, who wrote about it and used words almost exactly like William Bartram used to describe this place on the edge of Mobile and Clark and Monroe counties. He used it in his poetry, and it became a sort of a symbol for Europe of what a great, beautiful tropical treasure should be. And it became this, the Southeast became embedded in this poem called Kubla Khan, this vision and a dream about a stately, beautiful place that was a tropical paradise. This became the definition of a tropical paradise. Where you are for most of Europe. Fortunately, we were able to purchase about 8,000 acres with the help of Nature Conservancy and a lot of other groups. And it was open this weekend as the E.O. Wilson Preserve. Really exciting place. We'll talk more about it. And I'm thinking a lot about the Delta, and I really just want to tell stories about the Delta today because it's such a remarkable place. There are many remarkable places in Alabama. The Delta is not the most diverse place in Alabama, not by a long shot. Not biologically diverse. Every place you step in Alabama is incredibly rich, and the Delta is one of those places. But it's a unique place. It's a beautiful place. And it's a wonderful place to talk about. I think we're going to make the Delta our theme today.
FM Talk 106.5 with Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. Call 251-343-0106. Here again is your personal nature expert, Bill Finch.
Yeah, welcome back. It's Gulf Coast Sunday morning. It's an Alabama Sunday morning. I want to think about this place called the Delta, which is... Its influence is wrapped all around you if you're in Mobile and Baldwin counties. It's a massive place in many ways. Maybe not big enough to withstand, I'm afraid, the things we're doing to the edges of it. And I worry about its future. But we made some incremental progress. Over the past year or two, and thanks to the Nature Conservancy, thanks to Patagonia and the Holdfast Fund and some other donors, we've been able to preserve another large chunk of this big place. And it'll take a lot of conservation, a lot more than what we've done, to really even preserve what we have. Believe me. These things don't exist in isolation, but I have a little more hope. It's a cool place, the Delta. It's where the two of the largest river systems in eastern North America, the Mobile, that are part of the Mobile system, what we call the Mobile drainage, the Tombigbee and the Alabama rivers come together. Those two rivers would probably, and that drainage, that Mobile drainage, would probably represent the center of aquatic diversity in North America, except for the other major river system in Alabama, which is where the Tennessee River drops through Alabama, in northeast Alabama, where the aquatic diversity on a measurable scale is even higher. Extraordinary. But these are incredibly rich places. It's the reason why Alabama has more mussel diversity than all of South America. It's the reason why Alabama, along with this Mobile Basin, along with the Middle Tennessee Basin and the Choctahatchee Basin, are the reasons why Alabama has more fish species than any place else in North America. It's why you can go to almost any river in Alabama and find more species of fish than you would find in a few hundred yards of that river. You'd find more species of fish than you would find in all of California. Maybe in all of the east, of the West Coast, for that matter. It's really extraordinary. So the Delta is this place where the Mobile and the Alabama and the Tombigbee come together to form what we call the Mobile-Tensaw Delta, two rivers, two major rivers that flow out of it, three depending on how you look at it, the Mobile, the Middle River, and the Tensaw River, and they all converge again at the headlands right around Mobile Bay, just above the causeway. And in between is this massive, massive wetland, swamp. It's interesting because as a kid, I drove past it. My folks knew it intimately. My grandfather, great-grandfather knew it intimately. And his people, they were among the last people after the first great cut of cypress in the Mobile-Tensaw Delta. they were the Peckerwood sawmillers who were called in to do the things that nobody else would do. Get the logs out of the places nobody else could get them out, and they came in and did that. That's how they made their living. They did that probably in the 30s, maybe into the 40s, 20s, 30s, 40s, into the 50s perhaps. And then there was one more last cut when Scott Paper came in and decided, oh, we don't want any more cypress. They just take up too much room. And lo and behold, they cut out the last of those ancient cypress that nobody wanted for wood, because they were mostly hollow, but they were immense, and they were huge, and they were habitat for bears, and they were habitat for birds, and much of the diversity of the Delta, and Scott cut that out over much of the Delta. But a little bit of that cypress forest remains, and I see it coming up above the Tupelo swamp that is now claimed much of the Delta. And I knew it as a kid. I could see that forest from a distance. I could see it from the highway. And it was really illuminating when I was old enough to have my own boat and could afford it, and was able to travel the Delta myself in a small boat, exploring all those nooks and crannies, and saw more than the treetops, and realized, gosh, what an incredibly beautiful place. What a wonderful place. Place that I enjoyed very much discovering. This new parcel on the Delta is different than much of the other land we've preserved, because we preserved much of the Delta that didn't cost us much to preserve. That's the way we are. Most conservation is about buying the cheap stuff first. And that may be as far as anybody ever gets. But in this case, we're now beginning to think about, how do we get the edges? How do we get these beautiful bottomlands that have oaks and hickories and the giant cane brakes that were so much a part of the place that Bartram described when he paddled up the Tombigbee River? You should read that. You should read that. The magnolia high, high overhead. It's a really remarkable, remarkable description of that place. And it was one of the other great features, which was almost tree-like, was the bamboo. And yes, bamboo is native to Alabama. Alabama is the center of bamboo diversity in North America. Yeah. Amazingly enough. Not because of the bamboo we imported, and we imported a lot of it from China. We actually had our own. And it was famous, and it really sort of helped to determine how people viewed Alabama. In fact, the word Alabama, the people, Alabama is named for the people, the tribe, the language, the culture that shaped much of central Alabama, the Alabama people. And that word, Alabama, may in fact, we've always thought it referred to the thicket. Increasingly, we think that thicket is quite likely the cane thicket, the cane brake. So the people of the cane brake, the people who manage the cane brake, that's who the people of Alabama were. It's who the people of Alabama should be in the future. I hope they are. So it's a pretty cool thing, understanding all this and understanding the Delta in the center of it all, and being able to see that and being able to preserve it. I hope you'll ask me more about it as the show goes on. A really remarkable place. One of the interesting things is, you know, Ed called Alabama America's Amazon, and I should say it's North America's Amazon, because America's Amazon, of course, is in South America. But North America's Amazon, Ed referred to as Alabama. And it was all these places that contributed to this great diversity in Alabama. And that would be the Red Hills in Monroe and Choctaw County. And it would be places like Splinter Hill with its incredible diversity, which is now threatened, and we should talk more about that. It would be places like Mobile Bay, and it would be places much farther north where fish diversity is even higher. We'll be back.
You get Plain Talk on Plain Living. Let's talk about living and growing in the Deep South with Bill Finch. Call 251-343-0106 on FM Talk 1065.
Hey, welcome back. It's Gulf Coast Sunday morning. It's an Alabama Sunday morning. Boy, I want to talk more about the Delta, and we're going to do that. We have some questions. And Johnny sent me a picture, and it reminds me of the Delta, too. Johnny in Grand Bay said, gosh, I found this plant. It looks like maybe it's a weird sort of related to cucumber thing. And it is a weird sort of related to cucumber thing. It's a member of, it's called creeping cucumber, is one name for it. It's a wild cucumber. It's not the ancestor of the cucumbers we eat. It's a relative of those cucumbers. Molothria is the genus. It's found throughout Alabama in wet places. It's really interesting. And, of course, if you think about it, nearly every place in Alabama is a wet place much of the time. A little dry in areas now, but it stays wet. And so these species that people think of as only occurring in marshes may occur in other places besides marshes, but it's certainly abundant in moist areas and along bottomlands throughout the state. And in ditches, you're going to see it a lot. Molothria. Oh, melonette is some people calling it that. It goes down into Central America, and so it has lots of where people are more observant about where they are. It has names like Huaquillo, Melanchito, maybe Mouse Melon, you could call it. But it's a cucumber melon relative. And is it edible? I'm going to work on that. I always do, and I always mean to, and I'm going to think about it, and I'm going to study it, and I'm probably going to eat it myself next year when I run across some of those fruit. I don't know why I didn't do it this year. I kept looking at it and thinking, I need to eat that as soon as it matures, and I never really got around to the point of figuring, okay, well, when should I be eating this fruit? Turns dark, turns black eventually. It's one of the reasons why, Johnny, that we have, I think it's probably one of the reasons why we have squash vine borer problems early in the year, because those populations can build up on things like wild cucumber. I haven't proven that, but I suspect that's the case. We have enough of it that they can build up. And, of course, our temperatures in winter are very mild. But that's what you're looking at. Johnny's having a great time, too, with his persimmons. He loves them. And his garden is always looking great. So did that help? Somebody in North Mobile County called me and asked me about... And let me see if I can find that question... Asked me about a plant, Terry, in North Mobile. And she planted 140 purple sensation allium. I planted in port-shaped flower bed, etc. All the allium came up to a height of about 3 inches and faded away, never to be seen again. I'm questioning what I did wrong. I'm going to try a few more this year. Please give me any suggestions for success, and thanks in advance. You know, here's the thing. Wisconsin is a very different place, and Minnesota and New England are very different places than Alabama. And a lot of my favorite people are from those places. They're wonderful people. And the places themselves are wonderful, but it's nothing like Alabama. And when you go and you buy a bulb, more often than not, that bulb was designed and selected to perform well in certain climates, like maybe Indiana and Ohio and farther north, because that's where people were spending money. And so those bulbs are developed for those places, and the magazines are written by people who live in those places. And so consequently, when they tell you, ooh, purple sensation is the beautiful thing for your yard, and the person on Facebook says, ooh, I have purple sensation, and it's doing great in my garden, and she's from Minnesota, you got to think, God, I don't live there. I live in a different place. I live in Alabama. I live in Mobile. I live in Huntsville. Maybe in Huntsville you could grow this purple sensation allium. I will tell you that your success with those alliums in South Alabama is going to be exceptional in the sense that if you succeed, you will be the exception. There are a lot of things that go wrong with alliums. One is, I think to even have a chance, you would have had to have planted those bulbs in fall. Even if you planted them in fall, they probably wouldn't survive more than 1 year. And the signals that cause the alliums to bulb or to bloom may not occur here because our winters may not be long enough. And because the heat increases too early in the spring, there's a lot of things that can go wrong. I don't recommend you spend a lot more money on purple sensation allium. It's a fact of life. You live in a place that's extraordinarily different than most of the rest of the country. And consequently, when you're buying from these national catalogs, they're not thinking about you. They don't think about Mobile. They don't think about what grows here. They're saying, oh, this grows, I don't care if they say it grows everywhere. They're lying. It doesn't. I don't know whether they mean to lie or whether it just doesn't matter to them, but they don't know. And it's not true. There's so many other wonderful things you can try here. So I just can tell you I'd have no advice on purple sensation alliums because I don't think they're going to do well for you. There are some other alliums that can do well, and I have seen them do well. And even though they're pretty tough the closer to the coast you get, maybe in North Mobile County some of them will do for you. I honestly don't even know what names they are. I've just seen them blooming in people's yards in Monroe County and in Clark County. I don't know where they got them. I should experiment with that, and I'll think about that, and I'll think about some of those alliums, onions, if you will, flowering onions that might do well for you. Give me just a little time, and I'll think about it. Give me a call back, but don't try that one. I mean, you've already proved it doesn't work. Let's not worry with that one. All right, let's see what else we got. So back to the Delta. What are your thoughts on promoting ecotourism in our Delta? That's fine. You know, it's to me, ecotourism is about getting to know a place. It's not about seeing it through as if it were something on television. Something you go in and say, oh, isn't that pretty? And then you leave. And I think the best ecotourism is the kind of ecotourism that involves a person in the place. Not that encourages them to build a picture window that overlooks the delta, because that misses the point. The delta I know is not the place that I saw out of my car window. It's the place that I waited in. It's the place that I got my feet muddy in. It's the place that I smelled. It's the fruits that I tasted in the middle of the delta. It's the feel of that place. It's the feel of the palmettos slapping against you as you're going through this deep forest. It's all those wonderful, it's the sense of suddenly discovering this canal system that was built as a great city in 1200 AD. Something I never knew was there. And coming to the banks of it, parting through the salt palmettos. That's the experience. And thinking about those people and thinking about, why aren't they here anymore? What happened to that place? And that place collapsed in part because it tried to live too big on the delta without thinking about its footprint and its consequences. Interesting. It's finding those shell mounds that are so interesting. Feeling the crunch of those shells, which is 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 years of shells under your feet. Can we do that without destroying the delta? Probably. But I think to have a really successful ecotourism program, you have to go to the people who have the patience to learn. And who want to know, and who want to understand, as I believe Ed implied over and over again, if you want to know yourself, you got to know what's around you. You got to know these species around you. And there's so many reasons for that. And I think being in the Delta sort of helps you understand that in some kind of interesting way. So, yeah. I think it can be, but it's about knowing. It's about knowledge. It's about, you know, I think all of the places, I'm a terrible traveler, terrible at tourism, because when I go to a place, I want to feel that place. I want to sense that place. I want to taste that place. I want to smell that place. I want to feel what those leaves are like. And then I want to protect that place. And I want to understand what my role is here. And I want to understand how that place affects me. That's ecotourism. Otherwise, it's just tourism. Like going to see the Colosseum. Making a picture of it so you can show your friends.
When I was a child, my family would travel.
And going back home.
Down to Western Kentucky, where my parents were born. And there's a backwards old town that's often remembered. So many times that my memories are worn. And Daddy, won't you take me back to Muhlenberg County, down by the Green River, where paradise lay. Well, I'm sorry, my son, but you're too late in asking. Mr. Peabody's coal train is hauled it away. Well, sometimes we travel right down the Green River to the abandoned old prison.
This is...
Welcome back to Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. Questions on conservation, natural history, and gardening? Talk with Bill Finch. Call 251-343-0106 on FM Talk 106.5.
Hey, welcome back. It's Gulf Coast Sunday morning. It's an Alabama Sunday morning. We've spent a lot of time talking about the Delta this morning. Mobile Tensaw Delta. And I hope we can talk about it some more. It's a really extraordinary place. I have to remind people that it is not the only place in Alabama that needs preserving. It's not even the most diverse place in Alabama. Not by a long shot. There are places even richer. And interestingly, some of those richer places are the places that are along the banks of the Mobile Tensaw Delta. And inland, where people are building their houses now. Just got to say, the central part of Baldwin County, away from the Delta, had riches on almost, on many scales, much higher than the Delta itself. And we've lost those, and I drove through those and realized how much we have lost in northern Baldwin County. So if you ask me about how to save the Delta, I will tell you, look under your own feet. Think about what's under your own feet. Think about what we're doing on the land surrounding the Delta, because the Delta is the product of everything around it. And it's rich only because the areas around it are so super rich. The areas upstream, the Black Belt Prairies, the Red Hills region, even the longleaf pine system in Mobile and Baldwin County, all those places are incredibly rich, and they deserve their own attention. And yes, that's one of the huge things we can do now, is begin to think about, how do we preserve what's left? How do we not destroy the little bit that's left? Think about that. How do you get into the Delta? You know, that has always been the challenge. And the Delta is moderately intact, in large part because people had a hard time getting into it. At least modern people do. When the middle of the Delta had the largest city in one of the two largest cities in North America, about 1250 AD. The other city was in Malville, which was up the Tombigbee towards Tuscaloosa. And those two cities were massive cities by North American standards in their day. In those days, people didn't mind getting around by boat, and that's how they did it, and they paddled. And nowadays, we have these big, big flashy motors, and people drive so fast that they barely even know where they are. You don't need a big flashy motor. You don't need two motors. You don't need three motors. You don't need a big boat. You just need a small boat. You could do it with a paddle. That's the way Bartram did it. It's the way I've done it many times. Just use a paddle to get around the edges. We haven't made it easy. We haven't made it easy to see the Delta. We could have done better. But, you know, one of the things about understanding where you are is understanding its deficiencies. And sometimes we don't do all we should do to make the Delta more accessible. We were trying to do that at Blakely. And Blakely still remains a relatively accessible way to view the Delta, if not to get into it. But it's a good place to, I don't know, do they have a canoe launch there? I'm not sure. But, you know, canoe launches would be really nice, and there are some great canoe launches, and kayaks are probably better for the Delta Find a good kayak with low sides, good stability, but relatively long so you can keep it pointed. And that's a great way to get into the water to see some of this delta. And there are many entry points moving up and down the delta. It's a lot of fun. Join a kayak club so that they can help you. So that's one way to see it. And then you should annoy the fire out of the rest of the people in the kayak club by stopping as often as you can to explore the woods and say, what is that? And smelling those plants, that's how you get to know the delta. That's how you get to know the delta. You'll see the alligators too. They'll be in there everywhere. Really cool. But the important thing is understanding that where you live impacts the delta. Where you are right now impacts the delta. And to say, man, and it impacts Mobile Bay, and it impacts the Gulf of Mexico. Whatever you want to call it. I'm calling it what my grandma called it. I'm calling it what Hank Williams called it. But you call it what you like. It impacts that place, the Gulf of Mexico, where you live. And so thinking about where you live, thinking about the consequences of that, really important. Really important part of where we are. Let's see what else we got. Clay in Birmingham, a great book about the Mobile Tensaw, is John Sledge's Mobile River. And it is a great history of that, great history of the river. There's a lot to learn about the biology of the place, too. So that's another way of thinking about it. Well, we're going to be back. In our next hour, we're going to talk a little bit about some of the things I found in the Delta that could be really interesting for us to bring forward and to think about in our own gardens. But we're also going to talk about your garden. So feel free to give us a call, 251-343-0106, 251-343-0106. Some great photos of Paul Bayou and just some of the cypress there. These cypress are so interesting and weird. It's so nice now. It's finally happening. And you can look out across the delta now, and you'll see the Nyssa, you'll see the tupelos, the water tupelos. You'll see them losing their leaves this time of year. They go deciduous pretty early, and they do this almost every year. Those big old leaves, they have a hard time with herbivory. And it's one of the reasons why tupelo are relatively short-lived compared to, say, cypress. But the cypress are now 100 years into their 1,200-year cycle. We'll talk about that when we come back.
It's time for Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast with nationally recognized nature writer and award-winning horticulture and nature expert, Bill Finch. Bill shares his knowledge of conservation, natural history, and gardening. Let's talk about living and growing in the Deep South with your personal garden and nature consultant. Here's Bill Finch on FM Talk 106.5.
Welcome back, Gulf Coast Sunday Morning, Alabama Sunday Morning. You know, there are many deltas, and I'm going to just talk about this a little longer. It wasn't a few thousand years ago. Not that long ago. When people first came to Alabama, the delta was probably sitting near the mouth of Mobile Bay. And maybe even as far out as beyond Dauphin Island. And as sea level rose, as the Gulf of Mexico rose, it submerged those places as it moved inland. And Dauphin Island was left as a series of islands. It was a hills. There were hills at one time in this big landscape that is now 80 miles south of Dauphin Island. And it was a big terrestrial landscape. And in the middle of that was the Delta, way out in the Gulf of Mexico, probably right near the edge of the continental shelf. It's retreated, and we can see that retreat. So my colleague Ben Raines, who is big into scuba, had heard about it, heard about a cypress forest that was right at the mouth of Mobile Bay, out in what we would now consider the Gulf. And that's where the Delta was at that time. And as sea level continued to rise over the past several thousand years, the Delta backed up and changed in its character. It's really interesting to think about Mobile Bay, what you now know as Mobile Bay when people first came here. Listen to this. What you now know as Mobile Bay when people first came, not too long ago, actually. It was actually a big forest with a river running through the middle of it and the Delta south of there. Isn't that amazing? And that big forested area, if you could imagine looking out from Daphne or Fairhope and from downtown Mobile, looking out over a vast forest of bottomland hardwoods and other trees, that vast forest was probably incredible concentration of genetic diversity that we shared farther north as climate changed again and got warmer. And as climate got warmer, sea level rose. That's the way things happen. That's the way it happened. And Mobile Bay was flooded, and the new Delta began forming several thousand years ago, where it is now. It has more or less stabilized. We don't know how it's going to be affected as sea level continues to rise, which it's been doing for a long time and is now doing at a much faster rate. We don't ultimately know what that rate is. You get to take a guess at what it'll be in the year 2100. I hope you're not wrong if you guess low. But it could be pretty significant. The Delta has an ability to deal with that because it collects so much sediment. It can collect sediment, and as sea level rises, it tends to hold on to that sediment better up to a certain point. Up to a certain point. And so one of the things that's happened is that in spite of the fact that sea level's risen quite a lot since the 19th century, the Delta hasn't retreated a whole lot because it's gotten slightly better at holding on to sediment, in part because we released so much sediment from upstream. Who knows what's going to happen in the long term. But there are several types of deltas, and right above the causeway is this beautiful delta that has very few trees in it. And I love that delta. It is what you'd call a marsh. It's full of things like sedges, tall sedges that will look to you like grasses, but sedges have edges, and they're not grasses exactly. They're actually more closely related to lilies than to grasses, and they're pretty cool. They're all over, and there are many of them, and there are beautiful things like iris all over the place that bloom in May and just incredible April, and the Hymenocallis, the beautiful white lilies that bloom there, just incredible. And then later in summer, the spider lilies. And then as fall is developing, you're going to notice those areas are full of the things that, I don't know, you can call it golden glow. It's Biden's. It's a beautiful big Biden's that looks like huge sunflowers all across the Delta. Just an amazing thing. All of those wonderful sun plants. And one of the cool things about those plants is they live in a wet environment. They tolerate a wet environment. And you can actually grow them in your yards around Mobile Bay. In most yards, particularly yards where you have a hard time growing other things because it stays too damp, too moist. And they do quite well. And it's one of the things, and you're not going to be able to go to Home Depot and buy those. You're not going to be able to go to a catalog and buy those. So one of the other things that I think we can do is to band together at places like Mobile Botanical Gardens, take that place over, make it useful to you by participating in what happens there, and using places like the Mobile Botanical Gardens to help us propagate and develop plants that will grow in our own yard as freely and as beautifully as they do in the Mobile Tensaw Delta. We should talk about that. It's actually, a lot of those plants adapt pretty well to human abuse of the landscape because they have to tolerate a lot where they are, and so they deal with low oxygen environments. Really cool. Understanding those wildflowers at the forefront of the Delta. The cardinal flowers, too, really incredible things throughout the year. And we don't really utilize those in our own gardens. It's hard to understand why. And then we spend a lot of money on catalog plants that don't do well for us when we have our own resources right here in front of us. Something to think about. Something to think about. How are you going to do it? Are you going to go out and collect those plants yourself? Probably not. You're not going to be able to identify them. You're not going to know. I can guarantee you, you're not going to dig them up out of the Delta. You try it sometime. You better get a rope. Get somebody to throw you a rope so that when you sink into the muck along with those iris, trying to find the bottom of the roots, which you won't find. But it's so easy to propagate them. And it would be so easy to get to have our own propagation system on the Gulf Coast. That's something we're going to have to do. It's something we're going to have to do if we're going to enjoy our place and take advantage of our place. Things to think about in the garden. Okay, I said I was going to do it. That's it. What kind of lily are you talking about, B-Dark says. All right, B-Dark. There's a bunch of lilies that grow in the Delta. And a lot of them are more closely related to amaryllis than they are to the lilies that grow farther north. They're members of tropical lily families. And we don't have a lot of good names for them, but they're beautiful. They're absolutely beautiful. B-Dark, when you're traveling along the causeway, or even on that big contraption that stands high above the causeway, whatever we call it now, you look out in April and look at that white. And that's the lily I'm talking about. On your bended knees, I ain't gonna dig no more taters. I decline, I ain't gonna pick no peas.
FM Talk 106.5, home for plain living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. Let's talk about living and growing in the Deep South with Bill Finch. Call 251-343-0106.
All right, welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning, Alabama Sunday morning. B-Dark, and those of you who are interested in what kind of lilies, I'm going to spell this word for you, because if we use the dumb common names that we have, you're going to get all twisted around. You're not going to find what we're looking for because we're bad about giving common names. We're so uninventive. We're so dull. And so we can't identify. But let me give you this name, and I want you to look it up. I want you to look it up. You ready? I want you to write this down. B-Dark, others who are interested in what these lilies look like. And when you see these lilies, they're going to blow you away. I can guarantee you. And you're going to think, purple allium? Why would I want a purple allium when I could have this? I'm spelling it for you right now, and I want you to look it up on the internet. You can do that sort of thing now. H-Y-M-E-N-O-C-A-L-L-I-S. Hymenocallis. It means beautiful tissue. H-Y-M-E-N-O-C-A-L-L-I-S. Hymenocallis. And I want you to look up those lilies. Not all of the hymenocallis you'll see will actually grow in Mobile. Many of them will. But it's the one that grows so freely in the Delta that we're interested in right now. And it's so beautiful and so interesting. And they all have somewhat similar flowers. I think the one in the Delta is particularly beautiful, particularly pretty. And B-Dark, are any of you driving over the causeway, driving on the Bayway in April, kind of mid to late April, look for that white, and you'll see huge areas of that white lily blooming, and it is absolutely stunning. It's incredible. And you get in the middle of it, and it's just blows your mind. So why don't we grow that in our yards? It's hard to say. Instead, we try to make our yards look like somebody's yard in Minnesota, which is, by comparison, quite dull. I don't mean to... I'm just going to have to say that. Our yards are dull only because we don't take advantage of where we are. Amy reminds me of a plant from the Lower Delta that I completely didn't tell you about. What a crazy person I am for not even mentioning this. Hibiscus. And Mobile is a city of hibiscus. It's surrounded by hibiscus of all kinds. It's one of the great centers of hibiscus richness, sundriness, diverseness, diversity, biodiversity. All of those things, incredible number of hibiscus that grow and are native around Mobile. And the only one we actually grow, the only whatever I get questions about mostly, is that silly one from Malaysia that we call Confederate Rose, which is not the American Confederacy. It's the Malaysian. It's probably some Malaysian Confederacy. And it actually probably originally from China, but... And it's not a rose, it's a hibiscus, but forget that one. We have so many other colorful hibiscus, and they're so beautiful, and they're so rich, and there's so many varieties. And so Amy asked me about, had I ever seen star hibiscus in the wild? And I will say yes, and Amy knows how to tiptoe around all of my problems, because it irritates me when people call it Texas star hibiscus, because it ain't from Texas. It's from Mobile in Florida, and to some degree Mississippi, and it doesn't get any farther west in the wild. Have I seen it? Is it still there? I don't know. We've done a lot of destruction in the many places where I've seen star hibiscus in the wild in Baldwin County and in Mobile County. And it may not survive there anymore, but yes, it was quite common. We know it was quite common. We've got records that it was quite common in Mobile and Baldwin counties. And it's a beautiful hibiscus, this big red hibiscus. But there's so many other hibiscus that grow in the Delta, white and pink and just stunning big flowers that just bloom freely. And things like, well, what did we call Costalescia now? But other mallows that are just equally beautiful. We don't grow them in our yards. We don't have common names for them because we don't understand where we are. And we don't understand the richness of where we are. At any rate, what we could get from the Delta. Yeah, so the cardinal flower, I can assure you, the one that I'm talking about, Jim, in Georgetown, is not the one that will suffocate everything on your property. I think you're talking about a vine that, and that's one of the problems with common names, is that we kind of use the same common name for lots of plants. Yes, there are some vining red flowers that I think some people call cardinal flower. I don't think I would call them that necessarily, but that's okay. In fact, I'm sure I wouldn't call them that. But some people do, but that's not what we're talking about. In the Delta, the cardinal flowers are not vines that I'm talking about. They grow on stems, single stems, about waist high, and just full of these big, beautiful red flowers. And yes, the hummingbirds would love them. And they bloom in August and September, maybe starting even in July some years, but mostly in August and September, and really beautiful things. They're great. Different thing. I wish we had available to us. I wish we knew where we were. Isn't it a shame? I wish we knew where we were and took advantage of where we were in all the right ways. I mean, we just hurt ourselves by not thinking about what's out there and thinking about how to take advantage of it. Sorry about that. I gotta say. And it's so frustrating must be frustrating for you, for me to say, oh, you can't grow a purple allium. Because that's all you know, is what you see in catalogs. But if we only knew where we were, if you only knew where we were. Jim, I'm going to look up the common names for that. It's Ipomopsis is the Latin name for the flower that you're looking at. It's a vine. Let me look up the common names. I can't remember the common names for that plant. Only the Latin names are coming to me, but I'll come right back to you. I wouldn't call it cardinal flower. And you can't really correct somebody for their common name except to say, well, okay, but that a lot of plants share that common name because there's no official registry of common names. Wouldn't it be great if we had a name that suited every plant that was a common name? That's another too bad. Let's see. Yeah, so I got a vine from my old timer up in Smash Fort, and he called it a bleeding heart, and I put it on my front porch and went all around, and the hummingbirds love it. Is that what they call cardinal flower? I don't know who they are. That's the problem. So when you're using common names, anybody can use any common name they want. And so B. Dark tells me that Hymenocallis, that some people call it a spider lily. Yes, but you got to know that spider lily, B. Dark, as you know, also refers to those red things that come up this time of year, which is a very different kind of thing. So it's not like there's an official registry of common names, and so everybody, it's babble. People get to call anything they want to what they want to call it, and it doesn't always tell you what it is. Wish we were better about that. I wish we had. How can we get a Delta hibiscus? I think, folks, everybody wants things to be easy, but let's all work together to try to get these things propagated locally so we can have them.
Welcome back to Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast with Bill Finch. Ask Bill about gardening and nature in your backyard. Call 251-343-0106 on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning, Alabama Sunday morning. So let's try to sort out this cardinal flower things. And let's talk about the cardinal flower. I have never heard a vining plant called cardinal flower, but that's because I'm not omniscient and I don't know all of the common names people give to things. I've never seen a book describe any of the vining plants as cardinal flowers. So if you've got a vining plant and it has red flowers and you're calling it cardinal flower, I think it's one of two things. If it has leaves that look like cypress leaves. Jim, you see what I'm saying? Do you know what I'm talking about? The leaves are very finely divided and they're very, very thin little, into little thin little pieces. Usually people call that cypress vine. And it's invasive. It comes from another place. And it's South America. If and it's Ipomoea quamoclit. I'm trying to think if there's another one that is red like that. But except for the other native, which is Ipomoea coccinea, which people call, and I think this is a great name. It's great. Scarlet creeper, right? The creeping part, if it's creeping you out because it's spreading all over things, it's a creeper. It's a vine things, and it spreads along plants, and it can be a little aggressive, but it's really beautiful, and I really like it. And the hummingbirds like it. But I have a feeling that what you're looking at is the one that has the cypress-like leaves, Jim. Let me know. Or you can, you know, you're good at sending pictures. Let me know. So can your wife call it cardinal flower? She can call it anything she wants. It's just a question of whether anybody else understands what she's talking about. So... And getting confused, and it's really easy to get. It's so difficult. Yeah. So B Dark complicates my life by saying the red spider lilies are called naked ladies, and indeed they are by some people, and that's fine too. It's just our common names are just. It's like unraveling. You know how you get your hose in a knot. You know how you get a chainsaw in a knot, a chain blade in a knot. You know how you have to unravel a bunch of knots. That's what happens when you start getting into these common names, because nobody really had any official common names for anything. So we get to call things whatever we want, which is unfortunate, maybe, or fortunate, depending on how you are. People put you in jail for saying lots of things nowadays. Terry again from Fairhope, talking about spider lilies, the beautiful blooms, but they stay green all winter, even with 8 or 9 inches of snow, and I know you know that. So, depending on what spider lilies we're talking about, and most of them do. The Delta lilies tend to go dormant. Red spider lilies actually do all of their photosynthesis in winter. The red spider lilies are not native. They're not what we're talking about in the Delta. Oh, boy. And they're pretty, and they come from China and Japan, and they're very nice, and they have their foliage comes up in winter and dies back in summer. The Delta lily foliage comes up in April and persists until it blooms, and then kind of begins dying back in July. Sometimes there'll be foliage in August. And in your garden, it may persist much later into the year, but it won't usually persist over the winter. It's all where you're from. That's right. That's right. It's all where you're from, B-Dark. We definitely agree about that. So it gets complicated when we're talking about common names. And that's why I try to help you out by saying, if you want to understand what lily we're talking about, look this up. H-Y-M-E-N-O-C-A-L-L-I-S. H-Y-M-E-N-O-C-A-L-L-I-S. Sorry. That way, I know you're getting to the right page. I know you're looking at the right thing, more or less. At least you're in the right genus. And Jim in Georgetown, I am really interested. It's good for me to know about this cardinal flower. So I'm dependent on you to send me a picture. Or at least tell me whether the leaves are kind of like cypress leaves. That one can be a bit of a nuisance. It can really take off. I haven't seen the native one, the one we call sometimes called scarlet creeper or red morning glory. I haven't seen it take off quite like the cypress vine does, at least on the Gulf Coast. But let me know. I'd love to see a picture of what you're looking at. It helps. It helps to know. And sometimes that's what we have to do. So what are we going to do about, that's what I'm trying to encourage you guys to think about. This is something we don't exploit, is where we are. We exploit it in all the wrong ways by basically creaming it, by basically bulldozing it away before we even know what it is. So how do we take advantage of where we are? How do we really enjoy where we are in our gardens by using the things that we know will grow really well? And the Lower Delta has some great lessons for gardens, some beautiful lessons for gardens. Is anybody out there doing anything about it? No. Could they? Yes. How would you get started? Well, it's going to take more than one person, probably. It's going to need a community of people. Maybe not even a huge community, just a half dozen people getting together and say, boy, we'd really love to do this. Let's go to the botanical gardens and let's find out how we can get some people to propagate these plants so that we can propagate the plants that are native to the Mobile Tensaw Delta and use them in our yards. That's not that hard. I can't make that happen. I can't. But you can. Just a half dozen folks. Get together. Do it. It'd be really good from you. Really good for you. We have a caller. I can't see. I'm looking. Is it David? Have we got a caller, guys?
Hey, Bill.
Hey.
This is Paul from Grand Bay.
Paul, I'm listening to you. Thank you.
I need to ask you a couple questions. Me and my wife got two different cuttings. One is a cutting. It's a rose called Seven Sisters. It's a climbing rose.
Right.
And we got in water right now in the windowsill in the kitchen. And we also got some cuttings of some Thai basil that's sitting in water on the windowsill. Now, what I need to know is, should I start them in pots like being in late September and then put them in the ground, you know, like in the spring when the ground warms up? Or, you know, I'll take your advice. What should I do? Or what should she do?
So the rose, you've got a cutting. Does it have any roots on it yet?
No, we just got it like last Sunday. I don't know. I'd be honest, I hadn't checked. And my wife just went back over for my brother-in-law and his wife give it to us. And, you know, I want to take care of it because it's like my neighbors across the street. I hope it's that it's a beautiful little pink roses, you know, with tight clusters. But
she
just called it Seven Sisters.
Right. And it's the Seven Sisters are, which is kind of interesting, is a name for the Pleiades. And it's a name that's given to lots of plants that, in fact, produce many different colors as the bloom ages. And one has small blooms, and so that's the idea. It's seven different colors. Whether you can find seven different colors, I don't know. It's I can't remember the parentage. I think it's Multiflora, but yeah, I think you're going to have to root it first. As soon as you begin seeing little roots developing, here's a couple of things. If you've got it in water, you're going to have to change that water frequently. And there's several reasons for that. One, you want to keep the water well oxygenated. And there's some other problems that can occur. So every day you need to change that water if you're going to root it in water. I think this is kind of, this is Multiflora heritage, and it probably will root okay in water. But just be sure to change the water every day. And as soon as you see little white roots developing, you need to put it in good potting soil.
Okay.
And let it develop there. And then keep it, I think it's probably premature to put it in the garden given that you've started it the way you have. I don't think you can put it in the garden until next spring.
That's fine with me.
Is my guess. Right, and that's mostly about not what's the best time to plant outside, but how long it's going to take for those roots to develop in a container. So keep it close to you so that you can watch. And I think it's probably okay. I will say that if you want to root it in soil, it's probably better to put it in a moist place outside, in a moist, shady place outside.
But in a
because
pot.
In a pot, and you can watch it. If you, it needs the high humidity, and your house, you have your air conditioning in there to lower the humidity in the house, and that's going to make it harder for it to hold on to its leaves. The other thing I would tell you is don't let any buds develop on that plant. Don't let any flowers develop on that plant.
Right.
Or it will slow its rooting down.
I hear the music. I was going to ask you about the Thai basil.
Yep. So hold on. I'm going to come right back. We'll talk about it.
I will.
Have you ever seen peaches grow on people need to buy?
You get Plain Talk on Plain Living. Let's talk about living and growing in the Deep South with Bill Finch. Call 251-343-0106 on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, welcome back. So Paul is asking about how to root basil, and basil's pretty simple. It will root really well in nice moist potting soil, again in a shady place. But here's the trick. I think it's hard to keep it alive. It really needs to be treated as an annual, Paul. Can you get seeds from Thai basil? Seeds are pretty easy to get.
Okay, yeah, I just went and checked. The Thai basil's got roots on it, little white roots coming out. Now, the rose doesn't, and this is what they have heard about roses, like we buy. It's got a, do I need to cut it again? I'll replace the water. My wife's gone, but it don't have any roots. And do I need to, like, put a diagonal cut on it and stick it back down in the water? Because it's like it's maybe sealed up at the bottom.
Yeah, so cut it again. Cut that bottom off again. You don't need a lot of leaves on the top. You don't need any flowers. You don't want any flower buds.
Right.
and it will take it longer. What I would do, what I often do, is take my fingernail and scratch one or two sides of the stem just to wound it just a little bit, and that can help, I think. My friend Martin Vandergeesen, I just had a conversation with him, and he basically said a lot of the things, even using rooting hormones, are basically old wives' tales, that there's not a lot of evidence that rooting hormone makes a difference in many cases. I do think wounding it a little bit helps. Having a fresh cut may help in terms of its ability to take up moisture, but not necessarily to root. So if you're worried that the bottom is calloused over, cut it, clip it one more time, just a little bit, and put it back in the water immediately. It's going to take the rose longer than And with the the basil, you've already got, you've already mastered it, but let me say that it really is better treated as an annual. So find you some seeds for Thai basil. It'll be easier than trying to keep starting it from cuttings, because it's going to have a lot of issues. Disease issues are going to catch up with it if you keep starting it from cuttings.
Okay, I've never grown Thai basil, so that's why I called you.
It's pretty easy, and the seed from seeds, it's really easy.
Okay. The other thing I want to ask you about is, you know, you were talking about wildflowers, you know, in the woods of the Delta. What's that thing? I always just call it a wild rose. They're white, real white, with like a deep maroon center. But they run in the vines all through the woods or along hedgerows and stuff. And
well,
you see it around.
That is that if it's on a vine, it's a morning glory. And it's
real
one
white.
It could be. Yeah, it could. That's right. So there are a bunch of morning glories out there. Some of them are native. The one that is, for example, Man of the Earth, Ipomoea pandureta, something like that, is a big thing that we see along the edge of the Delta and has a big, big white flower. And it's a member of the morning glory family. There are invasive morning glories that are often purple. And the purple morning glories are often the invasive morning glories. But it's a member of the morning glory family.
The other thing I was going to tell you is about common names. We got that thing you call a cypress vine. I love. Yeah, the red flowers. Now, I didn't know it was called cypress vine. What I've always called it is, and it is invasive, big time, but I've always called it starfire, because, you know, the petals are like a star, and they're deep, you know, a bright, deep red, but that thing takes over like a prairie fire. I mean, it'll run along a fence. They got in a peach tree. My wife got mad, ripping it all down from the peach tree, but I love it. I mean, to me, it's great.
It's pretty.
I'll let you
go,
Bill. Yeah.
Paul, thank you.
Like I said.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Bill.
Good
talk to you. Yeah, and we're running short on time. I want to get quickly. Ultra Runner is talking about native crinums. And, yes, they're sometimes also called spider lilies. It gets very confusing. But the crinums are very different, and they're beautiful, and they do very well in gardens, and they're great. I've used them all the time. There's a funny story there. I wish I had time to tell it. I want to say to Amy, your sunflower is actually a silphium, S-I-L-P-H-I-U-M. And you call me back next week, and we'll talk about why that's a silphium and not a sunflower. And it's still cool. It's still a native plant. And it's really nice that you've got that there. Did I have one more caller? Do I even have time?
Well, I'll try to do it quick. Hey, Bill.
I
understand the state of Texas just authorized fracking water to be used in agriculture. So that could be anything. Whether somebody's got a horse and they buy alfalfa, whether they buy hay, whether it's going to be in corn or whether it's going to be in herbs, fracking water in agriculture. So I'm just wondering if you're familiar with this and what can we do about it?
Yeah, I don't know what to do about Texas. I've always wondered what to do about Texas. I'm not going to figure out what to do about Texas in the next 3 minutes. To all my friends in Texas, you know I love you. I don't know what to do about that. I don't think it's a great idea. I think I think there's a lot of potential for issues. I'm sure there are. What can we do about it? I'm not sure what we can do about it. If you don't like things like that, I guess we have elections, and sometimes people, you know, may go to the polls and say, God, I don't want to have fracking water in my vegetables. But I don't know. It's an interesting problem.
Boycott comes to mind. Yeah, but
yeah.
Texas is such a massive state. You know, how can we tell whether or not a product comes from Texas?
Yeah, you'd have almost no way to know, would you? And you wouldn't know what kind of... So it's probably going to... You know, agriculture in Texas is mostly now... It's a little bit about cotton. It's a little... But mostly a little bit about cotton. It's a lot about cows. So, you know, maybe you don't mind eating fracking water in your beef.
No kidding.
So, I don't know. It's an interesting thing. I don't know what to do about it, but I reckon I'll look it up and try to figure it out someday.
Yeah, it was just about a month ago. Early August is when the legislation went through.
Well, that's
so
really interesting.
This year's crop, yeah.
Yeah, all right. David, thank you.
My pleasure.
All right, so... It was a fun morning talking about the Delta. It's a fun morning because if we understood the Delta, we would understand a lot more about our place and a lot more about our gardens. And as Ed Wilson would say, we would probably understand a little more about ourselves. We'll be back next week.
South, how the weather in the Delta, how the food tastes in your mouth.